This is Chatter on Books, because everyone should have a podcast. And here's your host, Victoria, or as we like to call her, Tori Clark.
Excellent. Claude, thanks so much. Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. This is bittersweet. This is our last show for the summer. We're going to take some time off after this and retool and do some things, but thanks for joining us. In just a little while, I got to tell you guys, I have never had so much fun preparing for a show as I have for this one, because we are going to be talking with John Sayles. You can use the word legendary. You can use the word iconic. It relates to his books, to his screenwriting, to the movies he's produced. Original Independent is what he puts on his Twitter handle, which I want to ask him about. And I've been a huge fan for years. I got to rewatch Brother from Another Planet this weekend, which is so spectacular. We have to ask him about that. And we've got a few other things on tap. I've got something sent to us by our friend Ron Charles at the Post, and possibly a pop quiz. And Deserted Island is going to be a mixture of our books and movie themes tonight. And we're having a book and movie theme tonight because we have Anne Hornaday with us. Welcome back, Anne, Chatter on Books alum. Thank you so much for joining us. And writing that fabulous book, as we were saying before the show, Talking Pictures, which completely humiliated me as a movie watcher. And we have David Aldridge, and we have Claude doing all the important stuff. So, Anne, first to you, how's the pandemic treating you?
Honestly, Tori, I don't know if you've heard this from other people, because I have, but I've never been busier. It's the strangest thing. It's like when the theaters closed in Washington, which was the weekend, I think March 10th, we just immediately pivoted to streaming. And voila, there were so many interesting films streamed on Amazon and Netflix and Hulu and other channels that I would never have reviewed, having been tied to that theatrical model for so long.
Right.
That was really fun. And then, as you know, our beloved local independent theaters like the Avalon, AFI, and Cinema Arts, they then pivoted to the virtual release pattern.
Right.
That's been my mission, is to support that in any way we can. In other words, I'm treating those like theatrical openings.
Sure.
And just doing whatever I can to help support, you know, drive people to buy those tickets through those theaters, because it's just so important that they stay afloat.
Right. And is this something, so we've talked with very small business owners, we've talked with a lot of local independent bookstores, and they say, as challenging as it's been, they've been forced to make some transitions, to make some transformations that they should have made otherwise. Are you seeing this in what you do?
I do, and I also feel that that's where the art houses and the independent theaters are actually ahead of the game, because I think for many years, a lot of people have been telling the big multiplex company, right, look, you know, you're in the people business. You need to know your customers better. They kind of throw it on the wall and assume.
Right.
And the smaller theaters have always been in the community building business.
You know?
That's what they do. They're community hubs. They know their patrons. They nurture them.
Mm-hmm.
The patrons trust them with their curatorial judgment and also their business ethic. And so I actually kind of have a theory that I think the multiplexes are kind of learning the hard way, like that was always where it was at. And
right.
Maybe they were short-sighted and not understanding that a little bit more intuitively.
Yeah.
I just think the whole the virtual piece has opened up a whole new audience for them, because now they're getting viewers from all over the world.
Yeah.
Those are people that they're going to want to keep nurturing and keep in touch with. And if I have any kind of speculation about this, it's going to be that once they are back open and people are going to the movies and the theater again, I think that there will always be a virtual piece of the business, mm-hmm, that can help them move things over, you know, when they need to put it on the screen. I mean, there's all sorts of creative ways to do it, but we talk a lot about accessibility, and this week, especially with the Americans with Disabilities Act anniversary, this has been a real revolution in accessibility.
Yeah.
People are able to access, literally, films and festivals in ways that they would not have been able to do earlier, physically or financially or for any other reason.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. Pre-pandemic, and David was with me at a lot of these, we would go to some of the local independent bookstores and tape the show. And the sense of community they had, and they were a meeting place and a greeting place. And I think in the age of technology, a lot of people like that they could go somewhere and be with people. Now they have to be doing this virtually. But I do believe for the first time ever, people are expanding their horizons via the internet. It used to be, the internet was, if I love dolphins, I'm going to watch everything I've ever seen about, it's out there about dolphins, but only dolphins.
Right.
Or politics, it's even worse, even narrower. Let's find self-reinforcing. But this has forced people to broaden their horizons and watch things they might not have watched. Fingers crossed. Okay, make this prediction. So that certain things are obvious. Movies that we would have seen in the big theaters get pushed off. Releases are delayed, those kinds of things. Tom Hanks is crying because, was it Operation Greyhound? It's streaming versus in a big movie theater, which he thought it was destined for. All of that's very obvious. But a year from now, 2 years from now, God willing, we're back to some new state of normal. How will the pandemic affect what people are writing and how they're filming them and how they're producing them?
That's the question. And right, you know, it's funny because when I said earlier, everybody's so busy, when I don't have that many, you know, friends in the business, and I'm not a reporter, I'm a critic, so I actually have to keep people like John at arm's length. But I do have a few colleagues that I'm collegial with and friendly.
Sure.
They are busy developing. I mean, because this is valuable time that they can spend writing and they can spend polishing. I mean, John knows all about this, you know, just like taking that extra pass that you didn't have time for before. The biggest question I think now is just production, like the physical production and what it'll look like, what the protocols are. They're filming Matrix 4 in Berlin right now. I mean, they have a way to make that work. And I've heard through the grapevine that it's going very well, that they feel comfortable with it, that they have things in place that are that's making everybody feel okay about it. Guillermo del Toro was at Comic-Con, the virtual Comic-Con. And he was describing how, you know, the tricky part is working with extras. Then the challenge is staging.
Right.
You know, that's when that's about cameras and angles and stacking people in a way that you can distance them in real life. But then, you know, so that becomes this whole creative challenge. And I'm still waiting. I mean, early in this, like one of my first pieces was, who's going to be the first person to make a movie on Zoom?
Yeah.
You know, this grammar that, you know, this visual grammar.
Yeah.
Part of our lives now, and you know, that's part of what it means to be human right now, and that's going to make itself felt aesthetically in ways that are going to be interesting.
It's not only part of our lives, everybody's getting used to it, that the sound isn't perfect or people are different, and that's what we're getting used to. And one of the things I wonder is, a year from now, 2 years from now, am I going to be watching a movie and going, a movie made in the last 18 months ago, oh my god, there are too many people too close together?
Exactly. It feels weird.
It's jarring. Yeah, totally. Fascinating.
This is sort of, it's kind of an off example, but when I watched that video that Biden and Obama did last week that was released, that was an example of what the new normal.
Yes.
It's kind of like, well, of course you're 12 feet away. You know, this staging cinematically that would have looked so wrong, you know, that we must muster is the only way to do it now.
Yep.
It's fascinating to me. So you're right that it's going to be 2 years down the line in terms of the literal pipeline. And what,
I mean, very superficially, you used to watch every movie, and I want to talk about the 70s and your fabulous piece, Anne Hornaday's fabulous piece in the Post yesterday on the movies from the 70s have some lessons for us. But people used to smoke all the time. Smoke all the time. And now if you see a movie made anytime recently and they're smoking, you go, oh my God, right? That's deliberate, right?
Certain things
So 2 years from now, will everybody be wearing masks in the movies that we see?
That's the question. Yeah.
Okay, David, I'm honking Ann here, but it's just so much fun having her. So jump in, all right? So Major League Baseball was imploding this past 48 hours, and David probably didn't have time to read Ann's piece in the Arts and Style section of the Washington Post.
I didn't have time to read it. Are you kidding? That's the longest story I think I've ever written in my life.
I wondered that, but it was Hollywood Leave the Lifeboat, Enter the 70s, and my favorite part in this was the quote from Ally McGraw.
Oh, I know.
Well, you're talking about all these movies from the 70s, and it was diverse. Ryan's Daughter, Tora, 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 Little Big Man, Catch 22, The Owl and the Pussycat, and of course, Love Story. And when you asked her about it, she said, what I love about that list is that nothing has anything in common with the other nine.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
She's fascinating.
Oh, we have, you know, there's a backstory. Ally and I met a few years ago when we both were at Chautauqua, at the Chautauqua Institution.
With lots of people around. And
You know, what? What are and we've stayed friends and friendly. And so when I started to prepare this piece, I literally was looking at the year 1970, 50 years ago, you know, and there was love.
We were one or two. Exactly. David wasn't born.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was a youth.
sit next to us, David. We'll explain it all to you.
Yeah. There you go.
But what, but you know, and I think especially after that Peter Biskin book, Easy Riders, Raging
Bulls, yeah,
like that cemented a certain, I'll say mythology, you know, about mm-hmm. films and who, you know, what they meant and who was making them. And it was a part of the story for sure. You know, the Scorsese's and the Coppola,
sure,
obviously. But when I started to look, you know, when I looked at that list, I realized there was so much more going on, you know?
Yeah.
It was just everything. And I feel like that's something worth celebrating. I've always loved a balanced ecosystem, you know?
Yeah.
And what I most bemoan, and it's been completely parallel with my career as a critic, because I feel like it really took root in the 90s, that blockbuster tentpole,
yes,
franchise, super,
yeah,
and it's turned into a monoculture, you know, and I just can't, monocultures are bad. They're bad for the environment. They're bad for, yeah, people. They're bad for economies, and they're bad for cinema. And so that's just one, yeah, of the elements of the 70s that I wanted to kind of lift up. I wanted to look at the 70s through a new lens and see what lessons we learned and what lessons we should unlearn, you know, like,
yeah,
lessons, the wrong lessons we took away from it. So
sure. It's a great piece. Everyone should read it. And exactly what you say in the piece is why it is such a treat to have people like John Sayles on our show tonight. And we will get to him, and I promise, in a minute, and talk about his fabulous book, Yellow Earth. But I have something from Ron Charles, the Washington Post book critic. If you don't get his newsletter, you should get his newsletter because he's fabulous. And this, he had this in This Weekend. This is the pop quiz, Anne and David. So be mm-hmm. ready. So speaking of things a long time ago, the 95-year copyright limit for books written in the 1920s is expiring, which means mm-hmm. these books will be in the public domain. Here are just a few of the books from the 1920s. Ulysses, James Joyce. David and I admitted last week, Anne, sure,
never
been on the bookshelf for years, never. Never.
Yeah.
The Sun Also Rises, 1928. Only 5,000 copies were printed at first. The Great Gatsby, 1925. The Sound of the Fury by Faulkner, 1929. And I don't know when's the last time you've all read that book. Mm-hmm. But I went back to look it up, and then I remembered. It's enormously complicated. Four different, and it's got time shifts, and there's all these other things, which makes it really dreadful. But when Faulkner wrote it, he knew it was so complicated and it would be so hard to follow. He tried to convince the publisher to print different sections in different colors.
Oh, wow.
So think about somebody in 1929 thinking that outside the box.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like smell-o-vision or something.
Right. Shockingly, the publisher said no. That's not done. And of course, it goes on tremendous success. And then a few years ago, somebody did do it. You can get the book for about $350 bucks. I really thought, I was reading this last week, and I thought to myself, oh, I'll get a copy of that and I'll hold it up. Not that anybody sees the video of this. And it was $350.
Like, well, so, I mean, take
okay. it. But here's
the value store.
Exactly. Here's the pop quiz. So you have mm-hmm. Ulysses, Sound of the Fury, The Great Gatsby, The Sun Also Rises. Which one to this day sells about 500,000 copies a year?
Gatsby.
Ding, 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 ding. What made you say that? You're right, but what made you say that?
There's something universal about that character.
What is it? The more I read it, and I've read it a few times, and the more I watch the movie, Anne, I go, oh, come on, please.
You've never been able to get it. I mean, because it's, the, you know, here's my, and I'd love to hear from John about this. My pet peeve about adaptations of great novels like that.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's the writing, you know, it's not the plot.
Yeah.
In movies, you know, I think so often when they adapt something, it's just like they lift the plot and the characters and it's like, that wasn't ever the point. You know, the experience of reading that book is so interior, and it's about the voice and about that writing. And that's not a visual thing. That's a literary thing. So,
yeah,
because I think it's still assigned in high school, isn't it? Or is it? I don't know. Is it? Is that considered like a literature, an AP Lit book?
I'm sure there are some problems with it. Probably can't be assigned. But I am really curious. Last fall, David, do you remember on this show, we talked about assigned reading for incoming freshmen in college?
Yes.
And last fall, it was Educated.
Oh, right. Yes, the book.
The nonfiction book, which I believe is fiction. And it was on everybody's
you
list.
You hated that book, yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't hate it. I resent the fact that they called it, anyways. it will be fascinating to see what is on the required reading list for this fall. It'll change dramatically. Okay. Speaking of John Sayles, John Sayles, are you still with us with your great anarchist book?
Made Three Movies.
I'm still here.
This is so awesome. Okay. So, John, if you knew this show at all, you would know that 9 out of 10 people who listen are because of David Aldridge, and they're just in awe of David Aldridge. Huh. And I am in awe of John Sayles. And
so am I. So let's talk to him.
So David, all right, you can do part of the intro. Why are you in awe of John Sayles?
Because the movies he makes are so different. They're so incredibly different. And the fact that the same guy who made 8 Men Out made Lone Star is just like, huh? And those are like two of my favorite movies of all time,
right?
You know, and they're completely different and about completely different things and completely different themes. But they're brilliant. They're just so brilliant. Right. And as you mentioned, Brother from Another Planet is like I'm a big Joe Morton fan so I'm always going to be a fan of anything he does. But I mean, that in particular was just a fantastic film, and it's a completely different film from the other two.
Completely. Okay, Anne, you have to be professional and respectful because you cover and critique John Sayles' work. What is it that you like about his independence and what he does?
Like David, I respect the range. I respect the political engagement. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that it's been kind of weirdly pigeonholed as polemical or message movie, you know. But I think with John Sayles' work, it's just the warp and the weft of the thing itself. You know, I mean, that politics are a part of life, and he makes movies about life, and he will never leave politics out of them because it's a part of life. So it's never inorganic. It's never forced. It's just a part of the wider thing itself. And I think the way that he can do that, as to David's point, in so many across genre, across period, across subject matter, funny, dramatic. I mean, all of it. He's just one of the most graceful storytellers I think we have I think he's just a great American filmmaker.
So awesome. And he's a great American writer. John, we can't see you because we got this great black box that says Annika. So, but I hope you're blushing. But you just Google John Sayles. That's how I live. Google. And you see screenwriter, you see director, you see producer, you see writer, you see MacArthur genius recipient, you see all these things. One of my favorite things that I've read, and I hope this is true, is that you drew some of your literary inspiration from The Black Stallion by William Farley. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. It was the first, you know, I was a kid who read...
Kid in Schenectady, New York, right?
Yeah. I read kid books and adult books at the same time, just lying around. And The Black Stallion, I liked animal books. I liked books about horses and dogs and shit like that. I was the first time I realized, oh, the writer just did something. So in The Black Stallion, you very much like the movie, you're following the adventures of this kid. And he, you know, somehow gets in, you know, ownership of this incredible stallion.
It was a shipwreck, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, he gets back home with his horse and, you know, people want to run the horse against the two greatest racehorses of the day. And you're following this, and usually you'd figure, okay, the last chapter is going to be the race, and the kid's
horse is going to win.
And he's going to describe the race. And he gets to the last chapter, and the first line of the last chapter or something is, he'd always wanted to handicap a triple heat. And all of a sudden, you're in a totally different point of view of this old guy who's the handicapper for the race. He's the guy who decides how many little tabs of metal you put in the saddle.
Sure.
You think this, you want to slow this horse down. And basically you watch the race through this old man's eyes. And the last line is something like, he should have put another eighth of a pound on the stallion. And you realize, oh, the stallion won by a nose, you know. And another eighth of a pound, it would have been a perfect triple heat. And I just thought, wow, you know, he took me away from the emotion of the story, but then he brought me back into it from a totally different point of view, and it totally worked. And so I'm like 10 years old, and I said, wow, that was really cool.
And you recognize that at 10 years old?
Yeah. Yeah.
Crap, man. I was being dumped by older sisters at the Sewickley Public Library because they didn't want to babysit me. And I would take a left and take a left. David's heard this. And there was the section with the horse books. And I read all the Black Stallion books. And I sat there going, wow, beautiful horse, cool kid.
Yeah.
You saw that.
The other one that I noticed early on, I was a little bit older, was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I was in the play, playing Chief Bromden. There's a point in the middle of a sentence, he changes tense. He changes past tense to present tense. And at first I thought it was a typo. And then I realized the rest of the chapter from this Indian's point of view is in present tense. Oh my God, the Thorazine has worn off and this guy has come back to life and he's now living in the present tense.
And once Anne, did you know that?
Yeah.
No. Anne Hornaday, did you know that?
By the way, I do that all the time in my work. So I will thank you for, you know, I will now make this like, well, no, it's a literary device. Can't you see, man? That's why John gets the genius grant and we, you know.
Yeah, no kidding. We'll get to the genius grant. I knew somebody once who got a genius grant and he wasn't. It was a waste of money. So, John, you grew up in Schenectady, kind of a union town. You go to Williams. You're a psychology major, right?
I was basically a stay out of Vietnam major. And you had to keep
you didn't have bone spurs, did you? Do you? Because we don't like bone spurs on this show.
No. I had a bad back, but I didn't think that was going to do it. I had worked in hospitals already as an orderly. So I figured if I have to go, I'll go as a medic. But I really, A, didn't want to go to that particular war. B, I don't like taking orders.
Uh-huh.
Being in the military at all was not something high on my list. And you had to maintain a C-minus average. And I like to read animal behavior just for fun.
Huh.
So I figured I can take enough animal behavior classes to keep a C minus average in psychology. Whereas other things I might actually have to work. So a lot of what I did in college was go to movies.
How many animal psychology courses was Williams offering at the time?
Probably about one a semester. And that was my grade. That and the writing class, creative writing class, would get my grade point average up to a C minus.
There you go.
I recently had reason to request and receive my college transcript.
Uh-huh.
That was a bad move. I'm not going to. Thanks. I had to call a friend of mine that I went to school with and go, I don't remember taking these classes. And she goes, that's the problem. So, John, as I'm preparing for the show, and I had so much fun preparing for it, I spent so much time on the movies, on the screen. You produce Bruce Springsteen videos, and your writing, which is spectacular. And I thought, how does a guy move back and forth so easily and so incredibly from one genre to the other? And I read a quote somewhere, and you've got to tell me if this is true. And you said, with a book, you get to be God. With a movie, at best, you're an enlightened despot.
Yeah. I mean, my book, Los Gusanos, I did the Bay of Pigs invasion in about 5 pages. Mm. And I did not have to go to the costumer and have her ask me, are we going to see their boots? You know, because when you do a scene like that in a movie, it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
But in a book, I want the sun to shine. If I want, you know, people to be bombed on the beach at Playa Girón, I can just say it.
Yeah.
You've not only got to pay for it, you've got to deal with other people. And that's the great thing about making movies, because they have talents you don't have. And hopefully they can make your screenplay into 120% of what you imagined it could be. But you've also got these practical, the sun goes down. We can't shoot anymore.
Yeah.
You know, we shot a movie in the Philippines, and this idea of magic hour when the sun is just right on the horizon.
Sure.
In the Philippines, because it's on the equator, you have a magic minute.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And minutes are money, right? It's so much about the money now.
Yeah.
Right.
You can have a lot of control. I usually write, direct and edit my own movies, but it is absolutely collaborative. Mm-hmm. You were talking about Brother from Another Planet.
The best.
Once we hired Joe Morton, and I knew him as a Shakespearean actor. Mm-hmm. So I hired a guy I didn't really know for a part where he has no lines. And if you're book people out there, listen to Books on Tape, make sure you track down Joe Morton reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. He just knocks it out of the park. It's just incredible. Anyway, I had to go to Joe and say, look, I've got 4 weeks to shoot this in Harlem with a very, new crew. We were trying to hire as many African-Americans as possible And often they would be the head of a department where they'd only been somewhere in the middle of that department before. I'm going to be very busy. You're going to have to keep track of this character's arc.
Wow.
So ask me a question, but you know, we shoot out of order. So you're going to have to know how assimilated your character is by reading the script probably every morning and say, okay, here's where I am. And Joe just did it. And I basically never had, you know, it's a movie where everything is either first, second, or third take at the most. And I was able to rely on, you know, Ernest Dickerson worked on it. Wonderful people, you know, Mason Daring did the music for it. Wonderful people worked on it, got great actors. Dee Dee Bridgewater, a great jazz singer, did one of her few appearances.
Fabulous. She was fabulous.
And and so you get to be the despot, but you also have these wonderful people helping you.
Yeah, I promise. We're going to get to your book, Yellow Earth, which is fabulous. And when I finished it about a week ago, I was very sad because I didn't want to finish it. But let's just stick with Brother from Another Planet for a minute. And the very superficial takes on Brother from Another Planet, and Anne, correct me, Black E.T.,
right.
You know, Arthur, Forrest Gump, and the story, for those who haven't seen it, and the first thing you should do is buy John's book, Yellow Earth, and the second thing you should do is find somewhere where you can stream Brother from Another Planet. But it was unlike anything that had been done at the time in 1984, right, Anne?
I should say so. I mean, I remember seeing that because I was living in New York, and that was actually really before I started writing about movies, you know?
Yeah, you are a real journalist.
Someday I'll show you my real journalism. No, but it was just stunning, you know? And like you said, you can't pigeonhole it. You can't just...
No.
This meets that, you know, it's fish out of water meets, you know,
one's a cop, one's a
exactly. It was just absolutely breathtaking. And, and of a piece with this oeuvre of this man who continually did it. And
awesome. Okay, John, let's talk about Yellow Earth, but here's the transition. So Chris Cooper, who is also in my obsession category, to whom you gave his first job in Matewan, I believe. Yep. And you got to tell me if this is accurate or not, but I read in a few different places on the interweb, so it must be true. He once said, you don't, even on this show, can I say it, David?
It's your show.
It's my show, yeah. You don't fuck with a John Sayles script. So I believe Chris Cooper said that, not Tory Clark. And if AOC can say it on the floor of the House of Representatives, I can say it on my podcast. So you don't bleep with a John Sayles script. Does the same hold true with your books? And by the way, we will talk about Yellow Earth because it's a really fabulous book, but we should also talk about Union Dues. We should also talk about your short stories. It's one of the things you like about writing books, the control?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't have an editor I had a copy editor, but not an editor on Yellow Earth. And that was just, I think, time and money. I had a very nice editor. On my previous book, A Moment in the Sun, who, you know, it's a 1,000-page book or a couple more than 1,000. And I love this editor because after he read it twice, first of all, getting an editor to read a 1,000-page book twice is like, this guy's really doing his job.
Yeah, no kidding.
I think you may have to write a few more short chapters instead of saying you have to cut 300 pages. But yeah, it's you have a kind of control over it. And as I said, you don't have to think about those practical things.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing with books as opposed to movies, Yellow Earth has probably 25 chapters from a different person's point of view. Now, a lot of my books are like this. And you may come back to that person later on, or they may just have one chapter and disappear forever. In a movie, if you have 4 points of view, you're really pushing the audience.
Is that true, Anne?
Well, I mean, I think...
not a miniseries, but a movie.
Well, you know, Lone Star, I still think Lone Star is a masterpiece of that. I mean, what would you say about that, John? There were more than... you had 4 cardinal points of view, you know, 4 main points of view.
Just about 4. You had Joe Morton and Chris Cooper, who never meet in the movie.
Right.
She had Elizabeth Pena too, and her mother, right? Also,
have a little stuff with her. But those, you're not quite getting into their point of view the way you would in a detective movie.
I hear what you're saying.
Where the style of the movie. So in Yellow Earth, when you go into that chapter, you're not only seeing what that person does, you're thinking like they do. And the style of writing changes.
Right.
So in you know, my previous novel, A Moment in the Sun, is set during, among other things, the Philippine-American War. Well, Damon Runyon was a young man who was in that war. So his nickname was Runt. And he written a little for newspapers. You know, he was just a grunt soldier. And so during the book, I get to do a chapter not only in his point of view, but I got to write in Damon Runyonese.
Nice.
Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, really?
Yeah. Nice.
That's great.
Okay, so I get criticized on this show, John, which is a show allegedly about books, for not talking enough about the plot of the books. So Yellow Earth, which I'm not kidding, when I was finished last week, I was sad because I didn't want it to be over. But briefly, it's about a small town in North Dakota that is experiencing the booms, the busts of a shale oil discovery, which is not an uncommon story. But to what you were just saying, there was this incredibly large and diverse cast in Yellow Earth. And you have the guys who are sticking the things in the ground, and you have corporate shills, you have tribal leaders, you have pole dancers, you have prairie dog reviewers, you've got all these things. How do you develop all these characters and how do you keep them all straight?
Well, I one thing that I did, I certainly did it in the previous.
Is there a whiteboard? Is there a John Sayles whiteboard?
I don't have, I've gotten to the point where I've written enough novels that in a novel like that, I've got the basic plot arc, which is there's a boom and then there's a bump. And it's based on recent history.
Yeah.
So you kind of, you know, just say, well, what was happening then? And you can drop the needle at various points. I've gotten to the point where if I'm bogged down somewhere or it just seems more like fun, I'll jump ahead 100 pages and write a couple chapters and then catch up with them.
Wow.
So what I do sometimes, and I always do at the end of writing what I think is going to be the book, is I take all the chapters from that character's point of view, and I put them together and I read them through for consistency of vocabulary, consistency of tone, make sure, you know, Faulkner occasionally would start to, you know, spell characters differently because
He was obsessed with color fonts, as we know.
Ratliff, who shows up in a lot of his books and stories, his name is spelled about three different ways because he was too lazy to get up and, you know, look on his shelf for one of his old books. But I will do that. But yeah, I do have this feeling, well, who do we want to hear from now? Who do we have to hear from now? And so the editing that I do myself is, oh, I've got this thing about three chapters later than it should show up or three chapters earlier than it can show up because this hasn't happened yet.
Hmm. Okay. But let's get really literal about this. And Anne, interrupt if this is a dumb question. I can't keep straight. Oh, I got to pick up dog food and Ziploc bags when I go to the grocery store. How do you keep it straight? What, take us in the mind or the practice of John Sayles as you're writing something like this.
You know, I think whatever I'm immersed in, I am immersed in it so heavily. I'm often writing a screenplay and a novel at the same time.
Again, I can't keep the dog food and the Ziploc bag straight. So
another underachiever on the show.
Really, F you, John Sayles, but okay.
Early on, I was writing screenplays at the same time. And I remember being at a cheesy motel in Los Angeles, and I was working on both Alligator and The Howling at the same time. And
awesome.
I forgot who was coming to visit. So when there was a knock on the door, I had to say, who is it? And quickly take one piece of paper out of the typewriter, back when you had typewriters like that, and put it on a different one. So they think I was
awesome.
Working on the movie. once you're in Alligator Land, you're in Alligator Land. Once you're the book that I finished since I finished, you know, Yellow Earth is set in the 1750s and 1750s. And once you're in the 1750s, you're in the 1750s. Has nothing to do with shale oil.
But how can you, I was going to ask you this, like I would imagine as a nut for a novel and a screenplay, that to me is completely different headspace and a completely different, attack on the language and structure. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I just can't even imagine doing those. It's like patting your head and rubbing your stomach at the same time.
They are absolutely different things. There's a few people who do them both really well. Richard Price
yeah.
is a killer novelist, and he's yes. a killer screenwriter.
Yeah.
You know, my right. favorite in both of those.
Well,
but they're different. They're different talents. But there are some muscles that you use in both. And so, you know, when I'm getting into a character, you know, one of the things that I do for people who are in my movies, even if they're Chris Cooper, is I write a bio for every character. Mm. Even if you're a day player and you only have two lines, I write a bio for you. I do that for my characters in books too. So you think back into who that person is, what's going on in their head, what do they know, what do they not know? Is this before Freud? Is this before the women's movement?
Wow.
People knew the world was round. So you mm-hmm. set those ground rules for the character. And then the main thing that's different in writing a screenplay is a movie or even a, you know, even something that you stream and you watch over many nights. It exists in time. So, you know, let's say it's a 2-hour movie. I still write movies for people to sit down and watch the whole movie without interruption.
Right.
So you have to have a feeling for, am I 10 minutes yeah. into the movie?
Right.
Do the people know this character? Are they willing to listen to a lot of dialogue now, which they may not be, you know, mm-hmm. earlier on in the process? With a book, you know, my 1,000-page novel, a friend wrote and said, I just read your novel in 3 days. And I just realized this guy needs an intervention. He's in big trouble. And it was true. He was really having some psychological problems, and he was staying up and reading books mm-hmm. instead of going to sleep. And you know, we helped him out a little bit. But a book just doesn't exist in time in the same way.
Okay, I have to object.
Same thing with the rhythm of a dialogue scene.
Right. I read your book in about 3 days, and I didn't stop yeah. until I
but
was done reading it. And I also watched Marcella, which if people have not watched Marcella, I just like give up food, family, sex, rock and roll to watch Marcella, which is fabulous. But, John, how did you, again, I go back to the diversity and the depth and breadth of characters in both your books mm-hmm. and your movies. And in Yellow Earth, we do sell books occasionally on this book, John. In Yellow Earth, which everyone should buy, there are so many different characters, and they are so diverse. One of my favorite lines in the book, Jewel is a pole dancer. I'm not giving anything away. She's a pole dancer. She seems to be an extraordinarily successful pole dancer and making more money as a pole dancer than I've ever made. And she's in a dance, and she's trying to divorce herself from what she's doing and kind of have an out-of-body experience. And the line was, leaving the state of North Dakota for the state of no mind. Mm-hmm. How do you come up with that? Have you been a pole dancer?
The people I know who are pole, a lot of actresses got into pole dancing. Actually, Sheila Kelly, who was in one of my movies, was teaching it for a while. Mm-hmm. I know actresses who played pole dancers. One of the things that pole dancers do, they do a lot of yoga. Mm-hmm. And so she's a character who's likely to have done a lot of yoga and got into some Eastern stuff and said, oh, that would be great from when guys are, you know, shoving, you know, counterfeit $20 bills toward my crotch to leave the space that I'm in and go somewhere else, even though my body is still there.
Yeah. But you got into it, and you got into it so accurately, I guess, or so persuasively.
You know, that don't pole dancer is just her job. Then who else is she?
Yeah. But it was your job to get into her mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
And portray it in such a way. Again, I fell in love with everybody in the book, Yellow Earth, which, as David knows, if I mention the name of a book a lot of times, it's because I really liked it and I like the author. You got into the minds of the hearts and souls of everybody. The prairie dog woman, the woman who was studying prairie dogs. Come on.
Hey,
how did you learn about prairie dogs?
Classes I watched. You know, I've actually hung out with field biologists. This is a funny story. I got to go to Madagascar once just for fun.
Of course, as one does.
On the airplane, we had read about a woman who had discovered a new kind of primate studying she-fox and other lemurs in Madagascar, and she'd just gotten a MacArthur Award. And I had just become an ex-genius, so I had my 5 years of geniusdom, and it had run out.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm sorry. Can we have a commercial break? Again, I know somebody who got a MacArthur Genius Grant, and there was nobody less worthy of it. You were completely worthy of it. Explain for the three people who don't know, MacArthur Genius Grant, that's what they call it.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was when I got it either. Charles MacArthur's brother, John D. MacArthur.
Right.
You know, the guy who wrote the front page. Well, he was the white sheep of the family. The guy who made the most money in the family was John D. MacArthur. He sold insurance to black people through the mail during the Depression and right. made a fortune, and then got into real estate. He hated the idea of paying taxes so much that as he was getting older, he said, how do I never pay tax? And they say, well, take all the money you're not using and set up a foundation. Well, that went on for a couple right. of years after he died. And, you know, his buddies who were on the board were knocking down $90,000 a year just for being on the board. And they weren't doing much. And then one of his sons, who was not so conservative, said, I'm on the board too. Let's do something interesting with this money. And he's the one who said, well, let's look for people in their various fields who are doing something unique and interesting and maybe give them some money so they don't have to teach for 5 years. They can just do that thing.
Right.
So I'm one of the first filmmakers who got, like in the second wave of MacArthur's, I got this thing, and it was in those days, it was based on your age. So I was,
right.
you know, I was like 30-something, and they said, okay, for 5 years, you're going to get $32,000 a year tax-free. And I said, I'm for it. This is great. It meant that I didn't have to go back and you know, stop editing Brother from Another Planet, and I could just edit and not take another job.
And what did you plug the money back into?
Brother from Another Planet.
Yeah, see? Yeah. Exactly. Again, buy the book, or you know, Yellow Earth, and then watch Brother from Another Planet, because it was...
Anyway, to finish the story, we were literally crossing a rope bridge over a chasm, and we saw this woman walking toward us, this woman, white woman. She wasn't wearing a pith helmet, but she should have been. And in the middle of the bridge, we said, are you the woman who studies the things? She said, yeah, well, we both won a MacArthur Award. And she had just heard about it on the shortwave radio. So we stood in
wow.
the middle of a rope bridge over a chasm up in the rainforest with me explaining how the MacArthur Award worked. And she was so enthusiastic.
Wow.
And I think she said, I think my mother will finally take me seriously.
Spectacular. All right. So there's a Chicago Review of Books, John. I hesitate to bring reviews into these things because I think they're always so narrowly focused. But the Chicago Review of Books said, Yellow Earth, your book, is a deep and tremendous account of rural America. I think that's so limiting about the book. I think it's about life, death, and human nature, as my dad likes to say, right?
I would say it's about any society that has to suddenly deal with something it can't handle. This
right.
could happen in a city. To me,
right.
it's like we have this ecosystem, whether it's the prairie dogs or the people who live in Yellow Earth, which is what I named this town of 15,000 people.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, there are 45,000 people there.
Right.
Yeah.
Most of them who have come recently are young men without families or women, and the you know camp followers who come with them. Nobody can deal with that, whether
yeah.
it's the city or the countryside or whatever. And then you know you have to see, well, the people who come have their story too. They're just not marauders. You know, they're trying to make a living. You know, they've got their dreams and hopes, and they interact with each other or don't.
Yeah, that's what struck me about the story. Again, it's hard to describe the depth and breadth and diversity of characters in the story, but I could relate, not love, but I could relate to every single person in it, whether it was the corporate shill or the people, you know, the guys just trying to get some work, or the pole dancers or the prairie dog woman or the kids in the high school, whatever. Every one of them was just trying to live a life,
to
live a life.
Communities, actually. It's Yellow Earth, the town. And then the Indian reservation that's next to it,
yeah,
which is based on the reservation that's like one north from Standing Rock.
Yeah.
So the pipeline that they're trying to run through Standing Rock is the one that they're using to get the oil in Yellow Earth to where they want it to go.
Yeah. It was pretty awesome. Okay. Let's kind of get you out with this one. This might be my second to last get you out. With which character in Yellow Earth, your book, which everyone should buy from a local independent bookstore, with which character do you relate the most?
You know, in an interesting way, I actually forget his name, but he's the Mexican guy who has to, you know, he's an oil worker
Yeah.
And he knows he's working on the pipeline in Mexico back when you could take gasoline out of the pipeline and put it in your car and drive away.
Right.
So of course the narcos get into it. And he knows because he's a mechanic and he knows how to work things. Someday they're going to show up and want him to work for them. So he's got an escape plan. And then basically he's heard on the radio about this incredible boom happening up in the state of North Dakota. And because I've done a lot of hitchhiking and time with truck drivers, my first published short story was about a truck driver. Just that thing of being on the road and not knowing who's going to pick you up next, not knowing where you're going to sleep that night, not knowing what lies ahead, even if you're aiming at something, was so familiar to me.
Yeah. But he was also a couple months late to everything.
Yeah, he gets there.
It was Marcario, right? It was Marcario. Yeah, you're usually ahead of the game. Marcario, sadly, was a couple months.
It takes them that long to get there. It's not easy if you don't have a job and you don't speak English.
Yeah, okay. John Sayles, I don't know if you want to be called a legend, but legend, iconic, there's none other. There are superficial words that you can ascribe to you that kind of capture it. But thank you so much, A, for all you've done. For bringing this great work. I really, really, really hope everybody buys Yellow Earth. I was so sad when I was done reading it, and buy it from a local independent bookstore and then go watch Brother from Another Planet, because who would do a black ET in 1984, much less 2020? And maybe we should bring it out.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say one thing to Mr. Sayles.
Please.
One of my best friends, and I mean my best friends in life, is from Clarksburg, West Virginia. And she wanted me to tell you, because I told her I was going to be interviewing you or being part of it, how much she wanted to thank you for Matewan and telling the story of West Virginia history, because she thinks that nobody remembers what happened there. And you did. And I don't know, I never know if that's important to people when they make films or movies. Oh, yeah. That the people that lived there actually appreciated it. They really did.
John, can you talk about Matewan?
There is, Matewan is about a strike that got very violent in West Virginia coal fields in 1920. It was Chris Cooper's first movie. James Earl Jones is in it, and he's wonderful. The town of Matewan, when we made it, really didn't want anything to do with that history. You know, it's a massacre. It's not pretty history.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, because of the movie, there is a Mine Wars Museum there. We've done a couple events there. I got made an honorary member of the local UMW chapter.
Nice.
And they have not only embraced this history, they've gotten local people to talk about their grandparents' experience, and they brought even more into telling that story. So it's been a nice offshoot of that particular movie that the people themselves kind of, they're in it. We hired a lot of local people on the crew and the cast, but they've also kind of taken it to heart and gone beyond it.
Nice. Really nice.
That's awesome. That's great.
It's awesome. Okay. We've got Deserted Island to close this out, but I got to do a little bit of housekeeping first of all, which is that this is a great wrap up to the summer. I couldn't be happier than to have anybody than John Sayles to wrap up the summer. We're going to take a few weeks off. We'll come back after Labor Day with some terrific authors. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, everybody, for sending me your emails, your thoughts, your notes. Keep sending them. If you're going to Apple iTunes for who knows, God knows what reason, please review us, because for some reason they seem to make a difference. And Deserted Island, as I said at the start of the show, is marrying our two great disciplines. And John, I didn't give you any homework, but you can do this too. We might give you the last one if you think you could do it. Marrying our two disciplines of books and movies and your particular genius. So if John Sayles could make a movie about any author, David, Anne, Jory, John, who would you want John Sayles to make a movie about? David? Because you popped up my screen first.
I'm cheating just a little tiny, tiny bit because I'm I'm not sure he wrote books, but he wrote, and he wrote extremely well.
That counts.
Rod Serling.
Oh, awesome. Why?
Because Rod Serling's fascinating. I mean, because he wrote an anti-lynching story in 1957 that won an Emmy Award before I ever did The Twilight Zone, and was who acted like everybody else at that time, who was creative and cared about other people. And he's fascinating to me. And he wrote, and even when The Twilight Zone, if you look at The Twilight Zone, I mean, it's amazing. Progressive for its, yeah. its time for the 1960s. It's incredibly progressive when yeah. you think about the real meanings of what he's writing about or the stories he's telling. And he just seemed like a very fascinating guy to me.
Awesome one. Okay, I'll go next because I think Ant's will be better than mine and John's is probably better than Althorne. So I, as David knows, everybody, I am obsessed with John McPhee. Absolutely obsessed. Mm-hmm. And we talked about him last week. And I want somebody to do something special on him because he's a special guy. Mm-hmm. One of the great stories about John McPhee is that he was up for the Pulitzer a few times. Who isn't? And he's teaching a class in college. He's teaching at Princeton. And somebody interrupts the class. He's a little annoyed. And they take him out in the hallway and tell him he's won the Pulitzer. It's like, okay. He goes back and finishes the class. Doesn't say anything, nothing. Nobody knew until the class was over. They went out. But if you have not read A Sense of Where You Are about Bill Bradley, you're missing something. After you read Yellow Earth and after you watch Brother from Another Planet, read A Sense of Where You Are. So I want John McPhee. And I know you have to maintain professional distance. But hypothetically speaking, if someone like John Sayles could make a movie about an author, who would you like to see?
My dream team. I mean, I can say, you know, it would be Zora Neale Hurston.
Because?
Because I think when I think of John Sayles' work, another word that comes to my mind is regionalism and a great regionalist. And as he does in Yellow Earth, as he does in everything he's made, he plunges into the place.
Right.
And he gives us, especially in the movies, you can feel the weather, you know, you can feel the whatever it is, if it's fighting wind in Alaska or dripping tropical heat
right.
in Florida, Louisiana. And Zora Neale Hurston had such a fascinating life, you know, growing up in a primarily African-American community in Florida, studying anthropology with Boaz and Margaret Mead and being a part of the Harlem Renaissance. She was here. I live in Baltimore. She studied at Morgan State for a while, I think, or maybe the Feeder High School. But anyway, she's just such a wonderful, she had such a great journey. And her work was so incredible. And I just, when I think of her journey through our country, I wouldn't think of anybody better than John Sayles to
nice.
At the helm.
I like that one.
She had, okay. She had a book that just recently came out actually called Barracoon that was published. And I used it for research for the novel that I finished after Yellow Earth.
Wow. Okay.
And it's fascinating why it wasn't published. But she basically talked to a man who was on the last slave boat to come to America.
Oh, wow.
And basically had to go help him garden and pick peaches. And sometimes she'd garden with him for an hour and he said, that's enough for a day. And other times he'd sit down and say, okay, stay, I'm going to talk now. But she spent the porch time.
The John Sayles movie of that.
Exactly. Perfect.
I would actually, just because of the last thing that I wrote, Thomas Fielding, who wrote Tom Jones. He not only was a pamphleteer, then he wrote some novels to get himself out of debt. And then he became the first police commissioner of London.
Wow.
And then handed it over to his brother, who was blind, and held the job for another dozen years. I think those are just kind of fascinating times.
Unbelievable. Okay, you should do it. And when you do it and it wins all sorts of awards, we want to be invited to the award ceremonies because David and I like that. Okay, John Sayles, thank you so much. I mean, thank you for all the great work you've done in so many different genres. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us tonight. Anne, love you. David, love you. Claude, thanks for making everything happen. Chatter and Books is out for a few weeks. Everybody stay well. Wash your hands, and we'll see you after Labor Day. Thanks, guys.